2. Cultural Revolution. Tea Party Snowdover proclaimed a tongue-in-cheek unifying theme of Marxism 2000. An international conference of progressive socialist Marxists held at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst Point, one sponsored by the Association for Economic and Social Analysis that operated out of the Department of Economics. The September 2000 forum promoted Marxian approaches to social theory and radical social change. We especially seek to stimulate and facilitate open discussions, rethinkings, and extensions of Marxism. In our view, they can and should form an important part of developing effective movements in the 21st century for an end to class exploitation and the current forms of political, cultural, and psychological oppressions, including those based on race, gender, and sexual orientation. Point 2. Hundreds of participants sampled the radical agenda, which was rich in a range of topics suitable for America's social and cultural transformation to move Marxism's future forward. Table 2.1. Marxism 2000, Agenda Selected. The Strange Pleasures of Destruction in Capitalist America, a Marxist View of the U.S. Constitution. Class, Race, Gender, and Modernity, a Marxist Approach to the U.S. Congress. The People, Multiculturalism and Renewal of the Left, State Terror, Prison Intellectuals, and Imprisoned Dissent. Welfare Capitalism and the American Family, Rethinking Labor, Towards a Labor Theory of Culture, Cultural Policy, Economic Redevelopment, and the Desexualization of Public Space, Black American Cultural Revolution. Gramsci on State, Civil Society, and Subaltern Struggle, Democratic Coordination Structures, Incentives and Controls in the New Socialism. Marxism and Civil Society, Marx's Concept of Value, After the Cultural Turn. Most of the conference participants were university professors, including both presenters and attendees. They were an affable crowd and spoke big words about serious matters. Among them were several hard-nosed radicals. Some could be heard arranging private evening discussions about revolutionary agendas. This writer inadvertently crossed paths in the university parking garage with Zapatista subcommandant Marcos, leader of the indigenous revolt in Chiapas, Mexico. At the time, I had not seen Marcos unmasked. A photograph of Professor Rafael Sebastian Guillen Vicente, the Mexican Marxist behind the balaclava, was later released by the Mexican government. It seemed almost everyone at the radical left conclave was advocating some variety of socialism, Marxism, Maoism, anarcho-communism, and even Marxism-Leninism. Although disagreement persisted over important differences between their respective doctrinal prescriptions, Orthodox communists warned conference participants about the dangers of wandering away from the basics of Marx, and Lenin and others cackled endlessly about the ideas of Italian revisionist Antonio Gramsci. But most agreed that it was imperative to get a new left-wing movement underway as quickly as possible. The progressive socialist Marxists and other latter-day radical leftists agreed on the need to destroy the state as a part of the coming socialist revolution. There simply was no other way to achieve socialist governance in the United States than to crush the existing capitalist system. It was the prospect of this very same tearing down of the U.S. government that led journalist Alice Widener 4 decades ago to label all communists and Marxists teachers of destruction. As in my experience at the Marxism 2000 conclave, Alice Widener found as early as 1965 that the radical leftists attending the Socialist Scholars Conference were not peaceful reformers. They instruct their pupils to be against the entire past and existing traditional social and political order of things. The socialists' first strategic aim was to launch the social and cultural revolution on all fronts, then accede to political power, and finally dismantle the bourgeois structure and replace it with political forms that would be representative of the working class. The Marxist teachers of destruction seek to destroy our union as a people through fomenting every kind of discussion by means of class struggle, Widener observed. They seek to destroy our domestic tranquility by aggravating discontent, envy, and all natural, genuine, or fancied ills in our fallible human society, and by instigating riots and demonstrations certain to lead to violence. For the political, economic, social, and cultural realities in the early 21st century, as compared to the late 1960s, may differ in detail. But the overall progressive socialist Marxist goal of transforming American culture and destroying the existing form of constitutional democratic government from within remains unchanged. More than four decades have passed since Ms. Widener offered her trenchant observations about the teachers of destruction. During all of those years, nothing has been revised on the radical agenda except the intensity level of the left-wing pressures on traditional American values and the institutions of freedom that protect them. Although Widener did not use the contemporary catchphrase culture war, she stood on the threshold of its birth and the subsequent left-wing bludgeoning of American society and culture since the mid-1960s and 1970s. Quoting a position prepared for the Socialist Scholars Conference entitled "Towards a Socialist Strategy for the United States," Widener laid bare the structure and purpose of the effort to transform American society. It is clear that the primary strategic perspective of American socialism should be to launch the social and cultural revolution on all fronts. This means desanctifying and putting into crisis all capitalist institutions and social relationships. The Marxist notion of violent upheaval and seizure of power in the United States was put aside as being a task too great. 6. Rather, the socialist scholar's goal was to prepare for that glorious day. By fomenting a cultural transformation through the direct and indirect activities of a new revolutionary vanguard steeped in the revisionist Marxism of Antonio Gramsci. If the progressive socialist Marxists transformed American culture, they would be in a position to achieve power with minimal violence through transformation before the ascension of the working class to political power. American communists sought nothing less than the revolutionary transformation of society into a perfect egalitarian socialism that delivered material and cultural abundance without oppression of any sort. John Earl Haynes and Harvey Clare, the deans of research and analysis of American communism, concluded. This was no gentle utopianism, however, but a messianic romanticism that hated the existing world with its myriad imperfections and looked forward to apocalyptic change. 7. A massive social transformation in the United States. What is popularly called the culture war would prepare American society for this momentous event. While tearing down the federal government and shredding the Constitution through a passive revolution to make way for socialist governance, the radical left prosecutes two agendas at the same time. One is in the open world behind agents of influence masquerading as non-governmental organizations of ostensibly well-meaning social activists, whereas the other agenda goals are pursued from the darkness of the shadow world to transform cultures and ruling political systems. The open and covert activities designed to advance the left-wing goal of creating a stateless world order reveal the basic socialist principles that are being honed to become predominant influences in the American people's lives. Within the left-wing are elements with different degrees of radicalism. Some operate clandestinely from the shadow of popular front groups. For others, extreme actions must be taken to advance the cause of social justice in the face of well-entrenched political power in the industrialized countries. Most of these teachers of destruction are aligned with Moscow as a global geopolitical competitor, some knowingly in solidarity with Russia's goals and others conveniently unaware of their support for the Kremlin's drive for one world. Party-state socialist governance. Roots of the contemporary culture war. Today's culture war is designed by the revolutionary left, the new teachers of destruction, to enable them to accede to political power through stealth. Once they occupy key positions in America's liberal democratic government, they plan to crush the liberties provided for by the U.S. Constitution and Bill of Rights in order to destroy corporate capitalism in the name of the public good. Three sketches of the Marxist roots influencing today's culture war expose the realities behind the left-wing images presented to Americans. The first is critical theory. It was developed by Marxist scholars at the Frankfurt School that reached back to its 1923 origin in Germany. Critical theory provided the European intellectual driving force that underwrote many of the counterculture events in the United States during the 1960s and 1970s. The second Marxist route to the contemporary culture war in America draws strength and guidance from the strategy and tactics for achieving power developed by Antonio Gramsci, an Italian communist. And the third Marxist route is made up by 25,000 to 30,000 radical professors ensconced on American campuses across the country who have turned their classrooms into political re-education camps. These radical professors, wrapped in the pseudo-intellectual robes of critical theory and Antonio Gramsci, make up America's contemporary teachers of destruction. The revolutionary agenda of the Marxist professors in 2008 is the same as it was in the mid-1960s when Alice Widener warned that the Marxist teachers of destruction seek to destroy our union as a people through fomenting every kind of dissension by means of class struggle. They seek to destroy our justice. They seek to destroy our common defense. Eight, the difference today is that the teachers of destruction are several steps closer to undermining the cultural pillars of American society, setting the stage for their accession to power. Critical theory. Critical theory helped to radicalize today's neo-Marxist culture war. Rooted in the Marxist-oriented ideas and activities of a German intellectual brain trust assembled in the 1920s, the New Left radicals drew upon these early musings to sustain their assault on America. During the 1960s, critical theory rationalized the New Left's anti-capitalist and social change agendas. It accommodated multidisciplinary research in an effort to develop a social theory that would be sufficiently systematic and comprehensive to serve as a change agent for principal social and political problems of the present day. Point 9. The Institute of Social Research began as a part of the University of Frankfurt in Germany. Created to emulate the Marx-Lenin Institute in Moscow, European Marxism served as the theoretical basis of the Institute's program of study. Over the years, the Institute's variety of Marxist intellectuals conducted inquiries into empirical historical open questions, a materialist superdisciplinary social theory, and a critical theory of society. The term critical theory was adopted by the Institute during its World War II exile at Columbia University in New York. Critical theory was an attempt to synthesize specific elements of political economy and socialist politics. Since Americans were quite hostile toward any theory of socialist revolution and closeness to the Soviet Union, critical theory was chosen as a cover word for the Institute's commitment to the study of Marxism. Point 10 hints. Right from the beginning, Marxist images cast on the wall of Plato's cave were aimed at manipulating American perceptions and hiding the reality that critical theory served as an intellectual dagger aimed at American hearts and minds. Critical theory begins with a premise that all inquiry, thought, political action, and informed political behavior must occur within a framework of reference that accounts for history, society, and a synthesis of philosophy, the sciences, and politics. By showing the relationship between ideas and theoretical positions in their social environment, critical theorists claim that they expose the roots of social processes. Social theories for critical theory, Douglas Kellner explains, are thus forms of social practice which reproduce dominant forms of capitalist activity. 11. To take the summary view of critical theory one step further. While traditional theory uncritically reproduces the existing society, critical theory, by contrast, is an expression of activity which strives to transform it. 12. It, in this case, being American society. The Nazi seizure of power compelled members of the Institute of Social Research to flee Germany in 1933. After 2 years in Geneva, the Institute moved to New York, 1935-41, and later California, 1941-53. These intellectual Marxists established their presence at American universities, including Columbia, Princeton, Brandeis, and the University of California at Berkeley and San Diego. In 1953, the Institute of Social Research returned to the University of Frankfurt in Germany, although some of its scholars, most notably Herbert Marcuse, remained in the United States. During its years of exile, the Frankfurt School had become well known for its theory of capitalism's growing strength over all aspects of social life and its development of new forms of social control. German intellectuals at the Institute developed a critical theory, which rejected Western civilization and tilted heavily to an imaginative, utopian, Marxist vision, which was totally disconnected from everyday American experience. The critical theorists insisted that the logic of their thinking was sufficient to transcend reality. The superior minds of the Institute's intellectuals, they argued, would fashion truths without the need for verification of theory by experimental evidence. Critical theory's influence on the New Left in the late 1960s and 1970s ensured that American society would be infected by this Marxist malignancy. While it addressed many aspects of social structure, critical theory, in the final analysis, proposed activities that would transform society into one far more amenable to Marxism. Critical theory's struggle for social change was an important step in undermining the values, structures, and practices of America's free market and democratic principles. Special attention was given to the culture industries of U.S. capitalism. To the Frankfurt Institute's Marxist thinkers, the culture industries used communication to manage the people's consciousness and mask social conflict behind the scenes. According to the Institute's scholars, the mass deception conducted by the culture industries manipulated popular acceptance of current society and served as an ideological indoctrination to reinforce existing cultural standards. By identifying contradictions in society's belief in the existing system, these revolutionaries entertained a dream world where their rules based on Marxism would prevail. The cultural Marxists at the Frankfurt School set into motion, and then guided, the counterculture revolution of the 1960s. Herbert Marcuse was among the most active in promotion of critical theory's social revolution among university students. The new strategy of revolution was focused on a unique dispersed disintegration of the capitalist governing system and the establishment of a classless world. 13. Marcuse's young disciples of the 1960s are now the tenured university. Teachers of destruction, and their ruinous actions are aimed directly at American culture. Herbert Marcuse offered opportunities to further develop and teach a radical Marxist brand of sociology centered on culture and consciousness as vital elements of revolution. By the 1960s, the University of California at San Diego-based Marcuse was known internationally as the guru of the New Left. 14. Within this radical left context, Marcuse developed a comprehensive statement of the theory of a totally administered or one-dimensional society. He published One Dimensional Man in 1964. Marcuse argued that mass media, culture, advertising, industrial organization and management, and modes of thought had a synergistic impact on the existing governing systems. These conditions resulted in an erosion of the ability for cultural thinking and creation of opposition to the capitalist-controlled system. Marcuse questioned the very existence of a revolutionary proletariat in America and the predicted inevitable crisis of capitalism. This questioning of Marxism placed Marcuse at odds with the old left, but in a loving embrace with the new left. While advanced industrial society was deemed to possess the capacity for qualitative change, Marcuse posed the hypothesis that forces and tendencies exist which may break this containment and explode on society. 16. During the 1960s, Herbert Marcuse was celebrated worldwide as the father of the New Left. Brandeis University refused to renew his tenured position, prompting him to take a position at the University of California at San Diego. He enjoyed great influence and popularity in the 1960s and early 1970s. His lectures, articles, and counsel to student radicals continued to call for revolutionary change and radical opposition to bourgeois society. According to David Horowitz, Marcuse's most famous essay, written in 1965, was about repressive tolerance. Marcuse argued with regard to those possessing conservative views of liberal government and individual liberty that since they already reflected an oppressive and already dominant social class, their speech and access to cultural platforms could be legitimately suppressed. 17. The modern-day ultra-left ideology of cultural Marxism takes yesterday's Soviet Marxist-Leninist model and stands it on its head. Revolution on this alternative path no longer envisions a cataclysmic clash between workers and capitalists as the final act. Rather, contemporary revolutionary doctrine is far more dangerous. It is based on a nonviolent, persistent, and quiet transformation of American traditions, families, education, media, and support institutions day by day. The seizure of political and economic power remains a key objective, but this final act is really a first step in transforming the existing cultural order. The left's rage against the system is still dominated by teachers of destruction who counsel the disintegration of American culture. Herbert Marcuse was adamant that Marx's and Lenin's traditional ideas were old-fashioned and that what we must undertake is a type of diffuse and dispersed disintegration of the system. 18. Antonio Gramsci's formula offered Professor Marcuse a practical application of critical theory. Antonio Gramsci, The strategy for Marxist revolution devised by Antonio Gramsci in the 1930s is quite evident in the contemporary struggle between the guardians of American values and traditions and the propaganda and disinformation spun by the ultra-left. Gramsci's influence can also be found in the positions taken by the New Left in the 1960s and the 1970s. Likewise, followers of Gramsci are clearly present among today's puppeteers in Plato's cave, busying themselves with casting shadows of political correctness on the wall. Even though these deceptive images would never hold up in the glaring sunlight of reality, many Americans have been manipulated and find these deceptive shadows to be true depictions of life on Earth. At its base, the culture war in America is a war of deception waged by the contemporary followers of Antonio Gramsci. Born on January 22, 1891 in Alesh, a town located in the Sardinian province of Cagliari, Antonio Gramsci suffered from ill health throughout his life and experienced deep financial insecurity during his youth. Nonetheless, he was judged to be of such superior intelligence that he won a scholarship in 1911 to study at Turin University. It was at the university that Gramsci had his first contact with and actively supported the Italian Socialist Party. After the party split a decade later, Gramsci became an intellectual leader on the Central Committee of the Italian Communist Party. From May 1922 until November 1923, he was an Italian delegate to the Communist International in Moscow. When he returned home, Gramsci became a prominent leader of the Communist Party in Italy's parliament. Because of his opposition to Italy's fascist leader Benito Mussolini, Gramsci was arrested on November 8, 1926, and a year later was sent to prison for political dissidence. Following nearly a decade of illnesses that were never treated properly in prison, Gramsci died from a cerebral hemorrhage on April 27, 1937 at age 46. During his years in prison, Gramsci was able to smuggle 33 notebooks, more than 3,000 pages, of his thoughts about working-class revolution. He explained in the notebooks why fascism triumphed in Italy and why the Italian working class did not rise up against the capitalist superstructure and seize power during a political vacuum in 1921-22. These political writings, about 9 volumes of notes, were supplemented by nearly 500 letters that he wrote from prison to his sister-in-law Titania Schucht and a few friends. Titania resided in Rome and was the person most intimately associated with Gramsci's prison life, bringing him the clothing, food, and medicine he needed to survive. She exchanged thoughts and feelings with him in letter form and sent his notebooks via diplomatic pouch to Moscow. Gramsci's intellectual work did not emerge until after World War II, but by the 1950s his writings began attracting increasing attention and critical commentary, especially by left-wing intellectuals. Point 19. Pondering the events that brought Benito Mussolini to power and the meek acceptance by ordinary Italians, Gramsci concluded that they had been motivated to a quiet acceptance by the teachings of the Roman Catholic Church, which in Italy stood above all other societal influences in shaping the values shared by both workers, assumed to be oppressed, and the bourgeoisie. It was from this analysis and conclusion that Gramsci postulated a new pathway into the future for the proletariat, an ideology that some today call cultural Marxism. Gramsci's years in prison gave him a chance to devise a new and more deceptive pathway to winning power over the ruling capitalists. Although he was a deeply committed Marxist in ideology, Gramsci believed that Marx and Lenin overlooked the importance of a key reality that bound the workers and bourgeoisie together: Christian culture. As John Vinery observed, Gramsci knew that, unlike the non-existent proletarian revolution, which existed only as a mirage of the future, Christian culture was a hard rock reality that the people ate, drank, and breathed. 20. Gramsci set out to provide a revolutionary blueprint that would pervert the Roman Catholic Church's values of goodness and forgiveness into a mind control tool in the hands of the new Marxists. He knew that the working classes were defined by their Christian faith and their Christian culture. Christianity, Gramsci recognized, blocked the way toward uprisings by the workers against the ruling class. No matter how strong might be their oppression, the working classes defined themselves in terms of their Christian faith. Christian culture liberated the working classes against even the most repressive secular abuses. While Gramsci shared the worldviews of Marx and Lenin concerning a future workers' paradise, He knew that it had to come about in a wholly different way than through violent revolution. Point 21, a high priority item for contemporary radical leftists, therefore, is to destroy religion, a competitor for winning the hearts and minds. Necessary for Marxist revolution. For the left, worship of God must be replaced by a worship of man, or secular humanism. Focusing on the fact that cultural values in the West are tied to Christianity, Gramsci's strategy centered on destroying the influence religious values have over people. This hegemony of Christianity, Gramsci argued, is manifested by civil society institutions that influence government and the will to openly resist recognized Marxist initiatives. These institutions include the churches of all denominations, education from grade school to university, the mass media, electronic, print, and internet-based, the family, keynotes of popular culture, and others. The pathway to eliminating the hegemony of Judeo-Christian values, therefore, is through the activities of civil society institutions and the quiet destruction of the nuclear family. To establish a new hegemony based on Marxist utopian ideals, one must infiltrate these institutions, show people how Marxism touches their lives, and then turns them away from Judeo-Christian values to an accommodation with secularization, which will ostensibly meet their spiritual or transcendent needs when their inner selves are Marxized. This approach has already proven enormously effective in Europe and has achieved significant gains in the United States. Political warfare, not violence, is needed to challenge the dominant hegemony of the bourgeoisie. Capitulation will come after a long war of position fought across the associations and institutions of the capitalist civil society. It is important to recognize that political warfare, in this context, means societal coalitions striking to gain control through a cultural and ideological struggle, as well as bouts in the political and economic arenas. When the working class and its coalition partners gain control, the character of hegemonic leadership changes to nurture the new moral and intellectual order based on Marxism. Point 22. Lynn Lawner explains that Gramsci was well aware that his was a political strategy, one that would take a long time for consensus or a new hegemony to prevail over coercion. But Gramsci also was convinced that the strategy, strengthened by Marxism, would produce an enduring revolution once victory had been achieved. Only a Marxist party, Gramsci maintained, could become that new organism of civil society. The party that is a part of society, operating dialectically in relation to other parts and capable of founding a state for all members of society precisely because of its daily dependence on the active, conscious consensus of the great laboring masses. 23. Gramsci's blueprint for action serves as the driving force behind the contemporary culture war in the United States. Gramsci's overarching concept, John Vinery explains, is aimed at a complete secularization of American society to make way for Marxist hegemony controlling the minds of the population. What was essential, insisted Gramsci, was to Marxize the inner man, to secularize him to the point of godlessness. Only when that was done could you successfully dangle the utopia of the workers' paradise before his eyes to be accepted in a peaceful and humanly agreeable manner, without revolution, violence, or bloodshed. Point 24. Vinery's analysis and description cuts into the very heart of Gramsci's strategy and how it is being applied today in the United States with great success. This is an attack on the Christian mind and Christian culture in America, a stealthy assault that systematically touches what is inner and immediate to individuals and groups in their daily lives. The modern-day Gramscists are orchestrating America's secularization from deep inside the world's shadows and seek to clean out the Judeo-Christian values held by most Americans. Only then will Americans be ready to Marxize their inner selves. American and international progressive socialist Marxists from the Soviet era tuned to Gramsci's ideas in the 1990s in order to shore up their Marxist ideology. Though Gramsci also drew on Leninism in developing his slow-roll strategy for communist revolution. The driving force behind the adoption of Gramsci's model, laced with dollops of Marxist dogma, though with a few practical amendments, has been based on two mutually reinforcing goals. The first objective is an ongoing domestic campaign by American progressive socialist Marxists to tear down what they consider the corporate-controlled U.S. government and replace it with a governance by the working class. This campaign is not new. Rather, it is an intensification of a long-term propaganda and agitation program that has been designed to undermine American values and foment a massive cultural transformation, with special emphasis on secularizing the minds of Americans as a way of neutralizing the strength of Christianity. This is an important function on the radical left's agenda, for it dovetails with secularization efforts in Europe and elsewhere that drives humanity toward a Russian type of party state, which is directed toward eventual socialist world governance dominated by the Kremlin. The second mutually reinforcing goal has a long pro-Soviet ancestry, especially among the ultra-left in Europe. The idea behind the European Union has been to create a stateless civil society over time, one with greatly weakened national sovereignty and a concomitant strengthening of the Central European authority. In the 1990s, Gramsci's revolutionary strategy, drawing heavily on key aspects of Marxism, became the European radical left's model to replace Soviet Marxism-Leninism. Moreover, its doctrine was expanded from a Eurocentric model to a global village, to a socialist vision that would provide global social justice, and finally to a stateless and secularized civil society exercising a bottom-up people's democracy. In plain words, in Europe, Gramsci's formula is the radical left scheme for world governance in a convergence with Russia and under a confederation of the United Nations, the European Union, and supporting institutions, such as the International Criminal Court, which was put into effect in 2002. The United States is expected to join this new world order once the country's culture is sufficiently de-Christianized and Marxized. This is the case since Gramsci's strategy also absorbs Lenin's geopolitical vision of a world Marxist revolution falling under the control of a party-state operational center. The culture war in America is but a single theater of operations, though perhaps the most important. New Left. Members of the New Left in the early 1960s, said to be shocked by revelations of Stalin's murderous ways, romanticized Cuba's Fidel Castro. Over the years, Castro slaughtered only about 16,000 like noxious insects, as Lenin described his killings, for their political beliefs, a piker compared with Lenin's and Stalin's genocidal statistics. 25 by its own rationalization. The New Left captured the moral high ground of the communist movement by invoking Marx as a political weapon and challenging the old left. 26 but make no mistake. From the beginning, the New Left was not an innocent experiment in American utopianism, David Horowitz cautions, but a self-conscious effort to rescue the communist project from its Soviet fate. 27 In spite of its differences with members of the old left and their totalitarian enthusiasm, the New Left refused to break ranks and remained loyal to the revolt against bourgeois society. 28 Above all, the New Left refused to concede that Marxism or socialism, both integral to the communist idea, were themselves condemned by the Stalinist nightmare. Horowitz explains that among new leftists who were impatient to bring the system down, it was Marxism that provided the convenient axe. 29. The 1960s and early 1970s were tumultuous years for American communism. The red offspring from the 1930s had come of age. This was a pampered generation, red diaper babies that grew up in communist households where they had become brainwashed by Marxist-Leninist values. By breaking from the pro-Soviet old left making up the core of the American Fifth Column, the new left dedicated itself to designing a distinct future for America. American communists, responding to orders from the Soviet Comintern in 1935, adopted the popular tactic of camouflaging their activities and real intentions. Often referring to themselves as progressives, communists were able to hide their true affiliation. Sometimes they wore the mask of benign liberals or reformists. 30 David Horowitz explained yesteryear's false presentation of the communists' political beliefs. My parents and their comrades were indeed conspirators. Their secret names and secret organizations, the elaborate network of front organizations they created to camouflage their agendas, their practice of infiltrating and subverting liberal organizations, and the disingenuousness with which they presented themselves as progressive all added up to a suspicious case. And their hearts were loyal to the Soviet state. For them, Russia was the incarnation of the socialist idea. 31. Many new leftists collaborated with America's enemies in the 1960s and 1970s. Thousands of the new left worked with communist regimes in their intelligence bureaus. Cuban intelligence, the DGI, for instance, operated the Venceremos Brigades in which foreigners were brought to Cuba to help harvest sugar cane. The foreign volunteers also offered Cuba's intelligence service a large recruiting pool. Other new leftists had direct contacts with communist guerrillas in El Salvador, Eastern Europe, and Vietnam. Since they considered the U.S. to be the evil empire, cooperation with America's socialist enemies was a natural outgrowth of their loyalty to the revolution. For us, Horwitz says, the Cuban Revolution embodied first of all the hope of breaking with the tinted Stalinist past. We thought of Fidel as one of us. 33 yet, 50,000 of the educated middle class left the country, including doctors, teachers, and lawyers. Subsequent repression in the 1960s resulted in political killings, and some 30,000 Cubans who were deemed to be of questionable loyalty were thrown into rat-infested, filthy prisons. These measures led to a mass exodus aboard makeshift rafts to escape Cuba. 34. The new left's hero Fidel Castro looked more like a cheap imitation of Stalin than the mythical revolutionary he had been made out to be. Rejecting the old left's loyalty to the brutish Communist Party of the Soviet Union, the new left embraced the Cuban Revolution, black radicalism, alienation, and the Third World. The American Communist Party kept the new left at a distance in order to remain a faithful handmaiden of Soviet policies. 35. The new left scorned the old left's dishonesty in hiding its agenda behind liberal and progressive masks. Horowitz lamented, liberals were the real enemy. Progressive was a mealy-mouthed camouflage for a revolutionary agenda. 36. Focusing on their own particular pathway to America's socialist future, radical leftists in the 1970s and 1980s shared a worldview of the ostensible inequities inherent in American capitalism that resulted in a society of grievous social contradictions and a self-perpetuating elite power structure. Lifting a chapter from Antonio Gramsci, the radicals strived to achieve a majority perspective or ideological hegemony. 37. Martin Carnoy and Derek Shearer, for instance, argued for economic democracy. That would shift control of investments from corporations to the public sector and then reconstruct economic decision-making to emphasize control by workers and consumers. 38. Yet another line of radical thought pressed closer to Gramsci's blueprint. By advocating a citizen movement based on organic intellectuals, or those drawn from the working class, that would lead to a self-consciousness about its historic role. 39. Other leftists, agreeing that American society held many flaws and that capitalism was wasteful and repugnant, grasped Gramsci's formula in building a new collective consciousness. These radicals, or coercive utopians, according to Rael Jean and Eric Isaac, would begin a new cultural revolution through ideological cultural struggle. 40. G. William Domhoff, a professor of psychology and sociology at the University of California at Santa Cruz, is particularly notable for filling his classroom for four decades with anti-capitalist, hate America's governing system invective. Domhoff's central thesis, borrowing more than a little from C. Wright Mill's The Power Elite, 1956, is that the United States is ruled by a carefully interwoven governing class, the power elite. Domhoff argues, are benefactors of corporate capitalism that has emerged to dominate the American economy. This corporate feudalism, he says, led to a privileged few who attend private schools, maintain exclusive clubs, and ride the hounds on their vast farmlands. For Domhoff, simply turning the spotlight on the power elite is a revolutionary act. Nearly 40 years after his writings in the late 1960s and 1970s, Domhoff was still peddling his argument for creating blueprints to foster the post-industrial America. In April 2005, he was still pounding his well-worn drum. Those who have the money have the power. Money rules in America. The upper class dominates the federal government. And working people have less power than in many other democratic countries. Defining the power elite as leadership groups of the upper class, Domhoff arguably shows how these privileged persons dominate the federal government to serve their interests through use of corporate lobbyists, backroom super lawyers, and industry-wide trade associations as the agents of power. 42. The open question is how much academic pollution has Domhoff been responsible for over the years. Not only did his Marxist propaganda poison the minds of his students directly, but thousands of others indirectly as well through the use of his writings by other Marxists in their classrooms across the country. Somehow Domhoff escaped being tagged by David Horowitz as one of the 101 most dangerous academics in America in his book The Professors. Professor G. William Domhoff is nominated here for consideration as the 102nd most dangerous. His past and present Marxism advocating of cultural revolution deserves no lesser sentence. Peter Collier and David Horowitz placed their finger on the pulse of the new left's unfulfilled expectations when they noted that the 1960s have become the decade that would not die. The new left's tumultuous actions made it the destructive generation, which contaminated American society that persists even today. Some accomplishments by the new left were positive, but Collier and Horowitz agree that there was a dark side too. We had weakened our culture's immune system, making it vulnerable to opportunistic diseases. 43. One of those opportunistic diseases was the radical left's contemporary subversion of America's societal strengths to motivate a massive cultural revolution. The doyens of critical theory and new leftism opened wounds in American society that became infected with the Marxist strain of Antonio Gramsci. By sweeping away traditional American values, institutions, and the Constitution and Bill of Rights, the Gramsci left remains poised in the shadows to accede to power via the electoral process. Once in power, all things will become possible. Gramsci's formula for passive revolution makes it within reason to deliver America's head on a silver platter. Culture war. By the 1980s, the ever-dangerous true believers in radical Marxism, the teachers of destruction, turned to transforming American universities into instruments for revolutionizing American culture. These messianic Gramscists formed an academic cult. Based on Antonio Gramsci's blueprint to obtain the levers of power necessary to follow a passive revolutionary pathway that would undermine America's Judeo-Christian values and traditional institutions. 45. Burrowing into universities at a time when the radical professors were nearing tenure status, the new teachers of destruction served as Gramsci's Marxist intellectuals. In this way, the excess baggage of critical theory, Antonio Gramsci, and the new left found its way into academia, where Marxist professors trained the next generation to carry on the stealthy campaign of transforming American culture over the long term. Their goals, following Gramsci's formula of operating quietly and out of sight, is to destroy the Judeo-Christian values and the nuclear family that stand in the way of their Marxist fantasy world. These contemporary teachers of destruction have not abandoned their pursuit of destroying the American political system. They simply went underground and into civil society positions in academia, the media, politics, unions, business, and nonprofit organizations. Others entered government. Three major categories underwrite the ultra-left's Gramsci formula for the cultural transformation of America: anti-Christianity, the family, feminism, abortion, homosexuality, and sexualization of children, and re-education, preschool through university. Anti-Christianity. Christianity is the most important superstructure in the United States that must be eliminated for Gramsci's blueprint to be successful. Gramsci prescribed a unitary Marxist attack against Christianity, Malachi Martin explained, for Gramsci meant that Marxists must change the residually Christian mind. He needed to alter that mind, to turn it into its opposite in all its details, so that it would become not merely a non-Christian mind, but an anti-Christian mind. 46. This meant to erase any individual or group thought about God or reference to Judeo-Christian values. It meant to create an antipathy toward Judeo-Christian ideals and those that espouse these values in their decisions about dealing with modern life. Gramsci's blueprint for action, Martin explained, called for a stealthy attack on Christianity, one that had to be pursued by means of a quiet and anonymous revolution. Everything must be done in the name of man's dignity and rights, and in the name of his autonomy and freedom from outside constraint. From the claims and constraints of Christianity, above all. Accomplish that, said Gramsci, and you will have established a true and freely adopted hegemony over the civil and political thinking of every formerly Christian country. Do that, he promised, and in essence you will have Marxized the West. The final step, the Marxization of the politics itself, will then follow. All classes will be one class. All minds will be proletarian minds. The earthly paradise will be achieved. Gramsci's formula for replacing traditional Judeo-Christian culture with a new Marxist culture applied two main tactics. Repeat the same arguments over and over, changing only the literary style, and Secondly, create new secular intellectuals by reaching into the masses and elevating a unique anti-Christian type of Marxist intellectual. Because these new intellectuals are drawn from the population rather than the elite, they will become the spearheads of the new socialist order. Their secular mentality will reject the Judeo-Christian theology of history and of man's origin and his end. 48. How does the Marxist revolutionary go about developing this new type of intellectual from hallowed academic towers that will spearhead the transformation of American culture? While education is not the only factor to take into account, Alberto M. Piedra observes, a cultural revolution can only be successful if the educational system is firmly committed to the transmission of the new forms of behavior that the revolutionaries endorse. 49 hits. Anti-Christianity and education in the hands of the Gramsci Marxists are mutually supportive. Direct attacks on the family can boomerang and trigger defensive actions that could slow progress toward realization of Gramsci's goals. Hence, America's radical left chose to attack indirectly by ridiculing the family and questioning its underlying value system. In place of the family, relationships of all kinds are promoted as being normal options, including homosexuality, same-sex marriage, abortion as birth control, and unending propaganda of permissiveness through multiple channels, including Hollywood's entertainment sewer lines, advertising, television, radio, and the internet. Then Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger, and now Pope Benedict XVI summarized in 2005, we are moving toward a dictatorship of relativism that recognizes nothing definite and leaves only one's own ego and one's own desires as the final measure. 50. On the other hand, more than three-quarters of the American people identified themselves as Christian, and some 42% in the 48 contiguous states attended religious services weekly or almost every week. The South, less Florida, was highest with 50-59% reporting weekly religious attendance. The Northeast was lowest with a third or so attending services, and especially low in Vermont and New Hampshire. 51. Secular humanism is a political philosophy that rejects all forms of religious faith and worship, except the worship of man. When this philosophy of worldly things is placed into the hands of dedicated Marxists, it becomes an intellectual cudgel to smash the underpinnings of Christianity in American culture. University professors and other intellectual elites, the news media, and politicians, often in cooperation with the homosexual and feminist pro-abortion lobby groups, lead the charge against Judeo-Christian values. By pulling new Marxist intellectuals from the population, the left also capitalizes on any number of dupes, dopes, and useful idiots to pick up the arguments and repeat them over and over in a variety of communication channels. For organizations lead the anti-Christian secularization of American culture, American Civil Liberties Union, ACLU, American United for Separation of Church and State, People for the American Way, and Freedom from Religion Foundation. Each of the four anti-Christian groups apply the Establishment Clause, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion, of the First Amendment to the Constitution as a cover for their attacks against the Free Exercise Clause, or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. The anti-Christian groups are experts on the use of legal challenges to bludgeon communities and social groups into submission. Local government leaders often find it far less expensive to eliminate a Christian cross, no matter its historical accuracy, or eliminate a Christmas creche on public property than to defend their community-supported actions in legal battles. Together, the secular Marxist warriors, many of whom are from the ACLU, leave no stone unturned as they scour the countryside for even the slightest reference to Christianity on public signs, flags and banners, or use of the people's property. When the ACLU obtained a photograph of massed U.S. Marines with their heads bowed in personal prayers during a ceremony honoring the birthday of the Marine Corps, for example, a spokesman stated, "For them to pray is clearly an establishment of religion, and we must nip this in the bud immediately." 52. The ACLU has collected millions of dollars in awards from federal judges. Who pays? The cities, towns, and counties across the nation. Ultimately, of course, the ACLU is picking the pockets of the American people to build their coffers to pay their legal staff and for more assaults against the traditions of Americanism. 53. Perhaps the award-winning TV writer Bert Prelutsky best expressed the reality of the ACLU The problem with the ACLU is that it is composed in equal measure of self-righteous fools and fascistic bullies. 54. For the Gramsci-motivated radical leftists, erasing Christmas from the public domain is mandatory. Christmas and Easter, to a lesser degree, is particularly troublesome for the Marxist humanists. These two most significant days of Christian worship rub salt into the wounds that the new left cut into American culture. John Gibson of Fox News began his book, The War on Christmas, with one of the most inane true stories of modern America. A father accompanied his son to grammar school only to find banners and drawings celebrating Happy Hanukkah and the Miracle of Kwanzaa, but without the slightest reference to Christmas. However, a small undecorated tree that was called a friendship tree was sitting on a table. When the father asked the principal why it was not called a Christmas tree, the chief educator replied, "Oh, we're trying to make sure we don't offend people." 55. The War on Christmas is a major battle between traditional American culture and the future envisioned by the radical left. Traditional Christian beliefs have always been countercultural, Michael Novak at the American Enterprise Institute explained. It was so in the days of ancient Rome, through the Middle Ages, in the early period of the Enlightenment, and it is so today. Score one for the Marxist humanists. And then read Gibson's book and score several more points for the progressive socialist Marxist ultra-left that shreds the religious meaning of Christmas. John Gibson selected several telling case studies that underline the successful efforts by the left to make Christmas politically incorrect. This War on Christmas has many American uncertain. Should I say Merry Christmas? Or would saying Happy Holidays be safer, since the individuals may be of other faiths? Or should I say nothing at all? On another level, images related to Christmas presented in public can be troublesome, not just crosses and nativity scenes, but also Christmas trees, Santa Claus, and even Rudolph's red nose. Christmas carols? Forget it. Christmas may be Macy's busy season, and so it is for the ACLU and its three major anti-God consorts. The ACLU's actions reveal that they harbor a secret desire to lead the charge against celebrations of the birth of Christ as a way of supporting Antonio Gramsci. Oh, yes, they whine and explain that their actions are based on the Establishment Clause that prohibits any government support for religion, no matter how slight or popular it might be. But the fundamental issue is this: Gramsci's blueprint cannot be satisfied until Christianity's back is broken and erased from American culture. Only then will the mind control techniques of Marxism in the hands of the progressive socialist Marxists be used in guiding society into a liberty-busting socialist fantasy world. Hence, anything the ACLU, People for the American Way, and other anti-religion organizations can do to hasten that day may explain their Gramscian anti-God activities. The stakes raised by the progressive socialist Marxist anti-Christian crusade are enormous. Reform Rabbi Joshua O. Haberman explained the importance of having a culture based on Judeo-Christian values in his article, "The Bible Belt is America's Safety Belt. It's what keeps us, Jews and Christians, from careening into a moral abyss of death on demand, sex divorced from values, a Roman orgy and demolition derby passing as entertainment, drugs used to fill lives devoid of meaning, in a generation of strutting savages and Calvin Kleins." The family. Pope Benedict XVI delivered a traditional New Year's prayer on January 1, 2008 that criticized those who were hostile, even unknowingly, to the institution of the family, and who make peace fragile for the entire national and international community. The pontiff's focus on defending the traditional family has been a constant concern since he was elected in 2005. He said the traditional family, led by a husband and a wife, instilled values that promote peace and was an irreplaceable institution. Pope Benedict's comments focused on a slide in several European countries toward granting unwed and homosexual couples legal recognition, such as same-sex marriages. 58. For the Marxist left, discrediting the traditional family is an essential aspect of the culture war. The family is under persistent attack and ridicule in an effort to alienate it from a system of values based on natural law and an objective moral order. These assaults, Alberto Piedra writes, paved the way for a permissiveness that can only be harmful to the integral development of man, and he warns that a new concept of the family is being propagated. 59 children are specifically targeted by the progressive socialist Marxists for separation from their parents' moral teaching. Only by opening a door of independence from parental guidance at a young age can the radical left block a continuation of traditional culture. This much was recognized by Lenin, Stalin, Hitler, Mao, and Castro in creating their respective new communist countries. That's the blueprint, Bill O'Reilly of Fox News says. If you want to change a country's culture and traditions, children must first abandon them and embrace a new vision. 60. Permissive relationships of all kinds that are considered immoral by Judeo-Christian standards are now being accepted by increasing numbers of Americans accommodating themselves to the Marxist intellectuals in academia, the media, and in a clandestine army of agents operating under Gramsci's influence. Moral permissiveness is in and traditional values are out. The feminist and homosexual agendas, for instance, clash with traditional family values directly and indirectly. Feminism. Tammy Bruce, a clear-thinking feminist and former leftist, and David Horowitz, a former hardcore communist and new leftist, tell the story of the radical policies, myths, and activities of the feminist movement. The Feminine Mystique, a bestseller written in 1963 by Betty Friedan, is the generally accepted platform that launched the modern feminist movement. But in the fairy tale that Friedan wove, she portrayed herself as a typical suburban housewife, politically inactive, and, according to Horowitz, not even conscious of the woman question. Actually, Betty Friedan had been a clever communist propagandist for nearly three decades before her best product, the Feminine Mystique, exploded onto the American scene. Friedan had been a Stalinist Marxist from her college days through her mid-30s. She served as a political intimate of leaders of America's Cold War Fifth Column and a lover of J. Robert Oppenheimer, a young communist physicist working on America's atomic bomb. She attended communist front meetings and generally operated quietly behind the scenes. The truth be told, by 1963 Friedan was already well-steeped in the woman question and had written about it from the angle of Engels, Lenin, and Stalin in a publication for the United Electrical Workers Union. By 1966 she had created the National Organization for Women and set the women's movement on its way. Give the lady due recognition. Mixed among her lies and denials about her communist past, she introduced the idea that the U.S. national security containment policy vis-a-vis the Soviet Union put a damper on women's aspirations at home. American communists posing as feminists began to inflict a madcap picture of reality on young women. Friedan betrayed her deep hatred for America and shared her Stalinist mentality when she described America's typical family household as a comfortable concentration camp. 61. The consequences of radical leftists creating and directing the feminist movement are hidden behind a shadowy string of communist fronts that do not give a hoot about women's issues, except insofar as they advance Gramsci's agenda. Hiding behind progressive and liberal, the left insists that certain steps are necessary to stop racism, homophobia, and sexism, Tammy Bruce writes. What we fail to recognize is that today's progressives are not actually interested in dealing with those issues. They're simply exploiting them to further their much more complex and menacing agenda, which is all about power and control. Feminists denounce patriarchy, a blend of religion, family, and capitalism that is said to allow men to keep women down. American culture is especially singled out as the villain of patriarchy. 63. Feminism, by its focus on marriage as the source of inequities between men and women, came to the conclusion as early as 1969 that marriage had to be destroyed. 20 textbooks used in 8,000 college courses across the country in the mid-1990s expressed the view that marriage is more a problem than a solution. 64. Many still believe that the best hope for women's liberation in the 21st century is by taking a Marxist path. For gender inequality to be abolished, Australian Lisa McDonald opined, not only must women be brought fully into social production, but private domestic labor must be replaced by socialized services, and there must be a thoroughgoing, conscious struggle against bourgeois culture and social psychology sexism. 65. In moments of candor, feminists from the ultra-left will admit that the movement is all about destroying the traditional American nuclear family. Led by sloganeering feminists that seem to be persuaded by their own anti-American propaganda, a kettle of nasty, angry women has been spawned. The Vatican charged the feminist movement in 2004 with trying to blur the boundary between men and women and in the process threatening the family, which is based on a mother and a father. The nuclear family introduces Christianity to American youth, which helps to shape future culture. When the lethal effects of feminism undermine the natural two-parent structure of the family, a Vatican letter to the bishops explained, it makes homosexuality and heterosexuality virtually equivalent. 66. Such a commentary from the Vatican is hardly surprising given the harshness and success of the feminist assault on the natural relations between women and men. The cultural consequences of these attacks, Midge Dechter explained, includes assault on the traditional relations between the sexes, on courtship and marriage, and perhaps above all on the family that has made the deepest inroads into millions of ordinary American lives. 67. Since women were excluded from the 1964 Civil Rights Act, the National Organization for Women, NOW, was created to give women a seat at the national political table. Forever mired in a Marxist swamp, NOW operates on the premise that women are victims of repression and discrimination. Its political agenda includes a woman's right to abortion, gay and lesbian rights, and opposition to sexism, racism, violence against women, and sexual harassment. At the same time, NOW attacks Christianity and traditional values and sees men's behavior as oppressive. NOW also pursues an agenda of sideshows, including a project on sadomasochism and lesbianism. The organization refuses to oppose worldwide legislation against prostitution. It also advocates unrestricted access to pornography in public libraries. NOW's dark side is exposed in detail by Tammy Bruce in her books, The New Thought Police, 2001, and The Death of Right and Wrong, 2003. NOW's leadership betrayed the women's movement by diluting efforts with the broader Marxist concerns of social justice, including the cultural transformation issue areas of race, homosexuality and other sex issues, immigration, and social subject areas. Gloria Steinem, top feminist leader of NOW, is a socialist, Tammy Bruce says, so her primary concern is not with the quality of women's lives at all. She apparently is still awash in how awful this country and patriarchy really are. 69. Steinem holds an honorary chair at the Democratic Socialists of America, the largest socialist organization in the United States and an affiliate of the Socialist International. Patricia Ireland's support for the Communist Party is discussed in her autobiography. Her pro-socialist views and participation in pro-communist rallies in Miami exposed her political perspective. Ireland's friend and lover, Pat Silverthorne, was an activist in the Socialist Workers' Party, a radical left-wing group, identified with the revolutionary Marxist, Bolshevik-Leninist perspectives of Leon Trotsky. In the 1980s, the Socialist Workers' Party began identifying itself closely with the Communist Party of Cuba. 70. The National Organization for Women and other national groups are all about using women's issues as social leverage to advance Antonio Gramsci's anti-family agenda. The feminist groups that have most influence on Capitol Hill and Wall Street do not represent most American women, Kimberly Schutt explains. They may be savvy in politics and public relations, but they don't know or care about what most women and girls think or the problems they face in their homes, schools, and communities. Abortion. The National Abortion and Reproductive Rights Action League, NARAL, is the major political activist group supporting abortion, including access for everyone and federal funding. NARAL pursues a three-pronged approach as a nonprofit lobbyist, a charitable education and research group, and a political action committee for pro-abortion rights candidates. NARAL receives corporate and major foundation grants, including those from the Buffett, Packard, Soros, and Turner entities. Jane Fonda also is a NARAL cash cow. Fonda's leftist credentials are solidly pro-Marxist and Marxist-Leninist and anti-American. Her father, actor Henry Fonda, said that he began to worry about Jane after she had Angela Davis over to the house. 72. He had reason for concern. In November 1969, Jane Fonda told her audience at Michigan State University that, "I would think that if you understood what communism was, you would hope, you would pray on your knees that we would someday become communist." 73. Cato Bearne calls abortion on demand the holy grail of feminism. Since most Americans oppose the majority of abortions, feminists work hard to keep human fetus killing issues in the courts. By using the courts to insulate abortion from public opinion through an array of euphemisms and lies, feminists have been successful in misdirecting criticism of their radical agenda. demonizing their opponents and misogynistic religious zealots also contributed to their defensive posture. Feminist fundamentalism, Cato Biern observed, holds that the battle of the sexes can't be won unless women make war on the tiniest enemies of their independence. 74. Homosexuality. Similar to the case of women, homosexual groups are typically strong advocates of abortion rights. Many homosexuals possess a philosophy of sex without restrictions or consequences, the same sexual license agenda held by abortion advocates. This absolute sexual license unites those who advocate abortion and same-sex marriage. 75. According to their drumbeat, homosexuals are oppressed by whites, males, Christians, the wealthy, and even those pesky heterosexuals, or breeders in homosexual slang, who seem to be everywhere. Multiculturalism, therefore, accommodates homosexuals in the left-wing's name-calling political tactics, racist, sexist, homophobe, and other labels from their cheap-shot hit list. 76. The ultra-left wants a new society with no rules or ideas about morality that might compete with their vision of a socialist world. For the progressive socialist Marxist, decency, virtue, and other values of traditional America mean oppression. In order to manipulate more people to support their envisioned Gramsci-based culture, a stepping stone on the societal space to obtaining power, the hard left will say and go just about anything to present itself as possessing great concern and empathy for homosexuals who are oppressed by American culture. 77. Homosexual groups claim that their cause is to bring about the normalization of homosexuality in Western culture. For more than three decades, homosexual advocates, many from the radical left, have become a powerful political force on the American landscape, especially in getting their message out in the schools, media, television, films, and Christian churches. Homosexual activists won many victories along the way, which were spread to a larger audience through the echo chambers of television, movies, and the broader social justice message of the radical left. 78. When Nigerian Cardinal Francis Arinze, a Vatican official, said in a commencement address at Georgetown University in May 2003 that the family is under siege in many parts of the world and that the family is mocked by homosexuality, he triggered angry responses from several students and professors. Georgetown University, a one-time admired Jesuit institution reflecting Roman Catholic values, revealed the depth of its contemporary gutter secularism when theology professor Teresa Sanders, who was seated on the commencement platform, arose and stomped off the stage to protest Cardinal Arinze's incredibly offensive remarks about the family being mocked by homosexuality. Catholic teaching and good manners be damned was the message Georgetown University sent to the world. 79. The National Educational Association, NEA, has promoted the homosexual agenda for many years. In 2001, for instance, at the NEA convention, conferees considered a resolution to implement promotion of full-scale indoctrination of children to accept and affirm homosexual behavior. A.D. Bob Chase, NEA president, is quoted by Alan Sears and Craig Austin as saying, "Let me make it clear. Some critics want the public schools to be an agent of moral doctrine, condemning children and adults when they are not in accord with biblical precepts." 81. Actually, it was the NEA, Sears and Austin explain, that was condemning parents who object to homosexual behavior and believe that it should not be taught in public schools, accusing them of forcing their moral doctrine on children. Sears and Austin continued, "They are trying to push a doctrine of homosexual behavior on young children while condemning and ridiculing those, including parents, who hold the biblical principles and to undermine the beliefs they are trying to instill in their children." 82. Same-sex unions is another tool Marxist activists use in fostering a revolutionary cultural change. Gay and lesbian marriage, one activist says, will dethrone the traditional family. Another homosexual leader told activists that their goal was to fight for same-sex marriage and its benefits, and then, once granted, redefine the institution of marriage completely, to transform the notion of family entirely. Gay activists or sexual Marxists, Alan Sears and Craig Austin quoted one homosexual activist as saying, "Legitimizing same-sex unions is a warm-up act. Ultimately, activists want to eliminate any barriers, any signposts, that limit or channel the exercise of human sexuality. Stanley Kurtz, a fellow at the Hoover Institution, found that fragile families, such as the Scandinavian model of domestic partnerships and unwed childbearing, were 2 or 3 times more likely to break up than married ones. 84. The incipient logic from the experience in Sweden, Denmark, and Norway, where same-sex couples have enjoyed the same rights as heterosexual couples for more than a decade. Heterosexual marriage has been declining steadily. The main reasons, according to Stanley Kurtz, are, first, marriage is no longer seen as a prerequisite for parenthood, and secondly, marriage has become just another choice on a menu of alternative adult relationships. This framework leads to a perception that all forms of family are equal: married, non-married, and same-sex unions. Hence, same-sex relationships accelerate the contemporary trend away from marriage. The separation of marriage from parenthood has a devastating impact on children and opens them up to proselytizing by Gramsci-motivated members of the far left. 85. With Italian legislation pending in May 2007 that would give greater rights to unmarried couples and homosexuals, which perhaps could open the door for same-sex marriage, more than 500,000 Italians took to the streets to protest. They were met by a secular courage counter-demonstration whose advocates were waving in banners that read, "Family Day, No Thanks, Family Gay." 86. Another conspiracy of silence in America covers up the rampant number of sexually transmitted diseases within the homosexual and bisexual communities. Syphilis, for example, was close to being eradicated in 2000, when the rate was 2.1 cases per 100,000 population. But, as a result of men having sex with men, the national syphilis rate has made a vengeful comeback. After 7 straight years of increases, the rate in 2007 had leaped to 3.7 cases per 100,000 people, or a total of 11,181 cases. According to Dr. Kevin Fenton of the Centers on Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, STDs, sexually transmitted diseases, remain a major threat to the gay and bisexual men, in part because having an STD other than HIV can increase the risk of transmitting or acquiring HIV. 87. Since homosexuality, especially in men, is a high-risk action, it seems that if state officials are going to compel someone, especially uninformed children, to support homosexual behavior, they should first be educated on the dangers involved. Pre-Day of Silence lectures by qualified medical professionals and supported with appropriate medical slides or photos might best inform these hapless schoolchildren who are being set up by adults to make uninformed judgments. Let informed kids and their parents decide. Sexualization of children. Control the children and you control the future, wrote that infamous, well-known Irish-American from China, O'Reilly Tzu, in Culture Warrior. 88. Dr. Judith Levine, a member of the ultra-left elite and highly regarded in academia and the homosexual establishment, soft-pedaled child molesters, pedophiles are not generally violent. In a candid snapshot of what the radical left plans for the sexualization of American children, sex is not harmful to children. It is a vehicle to self-knowledge, love, healing, creativity, adventure, and intense feelings of aliveness. There are many ways even the smallest of children can partake in it. Our moral obligation to the next generation is to make a world in which every child, for accomplishment, connection, meaning, and pleasure, can be marvelously fulfilled. 89. Harmful to minors. The perils of protecting children from sex is another progressive socialist Marxist political propaganda hit against mainstream American culture. Levine argues that American parents are responsible for creating wellsprings of danger that are the very ignorance and terror we're instilling in kids, whereas the means of their self-defense are knowledge and courage. Sexual peril is real, just as terrorism is real, Levine said. But the kind of protection that is mobilized by fear, the kind that purports to keep the young safe by locking them in their rooms, ignorant and scared to death policies like abstinence-only education will not protect them. 90. This is not a headline story. After all, academics have been promoting pedophilia since 1981. Professor Gilbert Hurt at San Francisco State University, for example, argued the category of child is a simple, rhetorical device for inflaming what is really an irrational set of attitudes against sex with children. John Money, a professor of pediatrics and medical psychology at Johns Hopkins University, says that those who oppose pedophilia do so because of self-imposed moralistic ignorance. An article published by the Institute for the Advanced Study of Human Sexuality, Sexual Rights of Children, stated that there is considerable evidence to support the position that there is no inherent harm in sexual expression in childhood. 91. Moreover, the Federal Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals in San Francisco ruled, as quoted by Bill O'Reilly, that parents are possessed of no constitutional right to prevent the public schools from providing information on that subject. Sexual information to their students in any forum or manner. 92. Tammy Bruce's outrage over such arguments roars off the pages of her writings. The idea of normalizing the sexualization of children in the minds of the public is of great importance of leftist thinkers, she says. The only way these malignant narcissists will ever feel normal, healthy, and acceptable, Bruce continues, is to remake society, children, in their image. 93. The radical left's alternative press, however, expressed many laudatory statements about Levine's screed, harmful to minors. Levine's research is a trenchant look at America's failure to extol the erotic, the progressive. Levine's work recounts how the right wing, through sham social science, media sensationalism, and self-righteous congressional inquiries, convinced the mainstream that sex is by nature dangerous to children. In these times, and the greatest virtue in Levine's book is its hope that children might learn to find joy in the realm of the senses. The Nation. Re-education. Lenin moved swiftly in 1918 to consolidate power over the Soviet Union. At a special conference for Soviet educators, they were told that we must remove the children from the crude influence of their families. From the first days of their lives, they will be under the healthy influence of communist children's nurseries and schools. 95. Antonio Gramsci did not give up on Lenin's efforts to create a new Soviet man, at least insofar as Western schooling was concerned. During his scribbling in prison, Gramsci realized that the whole field of Western culture, as elaborated and diffused as it was, could not be protected. Hence, he chose those targets that appeared most vulnerable to stealthy penetration and conversion. Three main culture targets were selected by Gramsci: the family unit, as a component of the larger anti-Christianity objective, education from grade school through high schools to university, and the media and political parties. These targets, Malachi Martin explained, were all wide open to systematic and professional Marxist penetration. 96. Education is essential to cultural transformation, first to destroy the vestiges of the previously existing values structure and social system, and secondly for the inculcation of the new set of prescribed norms. Especially for the young, the education system is a key for the transmission of new sets of ideas and attitudes. Cultural revolution becomes natural and possible when the radical secularists control the family, the school, and the media, Alberto Piedra counseled. By these means, the new society, Gramscian one, will be given birth. Gramsci, in most of his writings, insists that the first and almost exclusive role of the Marxist intellectual lies in education, Piedra explained. The revolution, he believed, must be prepared with time, patience, and a calculating mind. This involves dismantling or destroying the values of the past by slowly infiltrating the old institutions and changing the mentality of the masses. 97. America's radical left is guided by Marxist intellectuals ensconced in America's universities and high schools. These teachers of destruction emulate Lenin's use of the education to build a wall of separation between parents and their children, one so effective as to allow a reshaping of America's young minds. It is difficult to avoid concluding that by conducting a stealthy progressive socialist Marxist assault against American culture through the education system, the United States has already moved well down the path toward establishing Little Red Gramsci schoolhouses across the country, from preschool through university. By converting American schools and universities into progressive socialist Marxist re-education camps, the radical left anticipates that it will be able to trigger a cultural transformation within the next generation. The curricula would no longer include Western civilization, civic education, and other courses essential to understanding one's linkage with traditional American institutions and values. 98. If this malignant cultural tumor continues to metastasize, it will eliminate individual liberty as it exists, even in its abbreviated form, in the early 21st century. In the place of traditional values would be, at minimum, a fascist, jackbooted civil order, and at worst a totalitarian socialist elite trampling freedom and liberal democracy. Overstatement? David Horowitz, a former communist and new leftist, has been combating the malicious left-wing indoctrination on American campuses for several years. He is quoted by Tammy Bruce as saying, "Beginning in the mid-1960s, the left made a concerted effort to take over our colleges and universities. As they've taken control, they've trampled free speech, virtually banished conservative professors, and turned our schools into little more than huge megaphones for anti-American rhetoric from coast to coast. 99. Progressive socialist Marxist professors proclaim expertise in cultural studies and focus on social constructs rather than the realities of daily life. By assuming this intellectual high ground, they are allowed to practice Marxist politics from the shadows of Plato's cave by inflicting their students with their hate-filled explanations of American society. New teachers of destruction." The Marxist professors and other members of the radical left scored enormous achievements on the underside of American society with carefully planned and executed political warfare. Masking itself behind political correctness, extremism, the radical left convinced many Americans that an extreme social and cultural transformation is needed to cleanse the United States for a better future. Through use of massive propaganda in the nation's schools, colleges and universities, Hollywood films and television, the workplace, and 1,000 other information outlets, the hard left turned the United States into a massive re-education camp. The Frankfurt School and Antonio Gramsci provided the right strategy to American leftists who, like coyotes smelling blood, sense a great victory for Marxism. Today's left has no Soviet Union as a beacon, former American communist Ronald Radosh observed in Commies, but its reflexive hatred of the American system is intact, and its devotees have no qualms about running off to join with the young. Self-proclaimed anarchists who trash Starbucks and picket the World Bank and International Monetary Fund, the institutions that for them symbolize the abiding evil of big corporations and international capitalism. 100 to be certain. The links between the 1960s radicals and the new left are at the core, the driving force, of the contemporary drive to revolutionize American culture. Many radical leftists said that the United States deserved the murderous September 11, 2001 terrorist attacks against the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. One protest letter signed by left-wing actors, writers, and academics suggested that the terrorist attack resulted from past U.S. military aggression, emphasis added. Actors Ed Asner and the late Ossie Davis, feminist Gloria Steinem, and many others urged all Americans to resist war and repression that had been loosed on the world by the Bush administration. It is unjust, immoral, and illegitimate. Two professors, Peter Dreyer and Dick Flax, writing in the longtime progressive socialist Marxist mouthpiece, The Nation, rightly observed that progressive and patriotism have rarely been used in the same sentence. These university educators expressed concern that the patriotic fervor triggered by the terrorist attacks on September 11th could be used to undermine dissent and progressive initiatives. They concluded that the left wing needed to remember its forgotten legacy. "We need to ask, once again," Dreyer and Flax wrote, "what is America to us?